The next topic, the ark goes missing from Jerusalem and the island of Elephantina. Ethiopian Jews, no rabbis, only priests.
I decided that I would do a book about Ethiopia's claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant.
Now, to make a book about Ethiopia's claim to the Ark of the Covenant, that is a very tiny, 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 insignificant week, according to Ion's version of the story. Would you agree, Ion?
Except for the Zionist box that may very well be in that Zion chapel that's giving everybody cancer.
Did the ark that the Carpathians had, did it require people to dance around and protect?
Nope.
If you looked at it, you'd...
Nope.
So the priest at the monk at the church, the Cathedral of Zion, in that Hancock meets, he's mixing up the biblical ark with the Carpathians ark.
Very good, thank you.
Okay, so we're...
And that book was published in 1992, and it's called The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant. And
that was my next question,
yeah.
Is why the sign and the seal? What are those things?
Well, the part of your question was also that it's assumed to be a myth that the question of the loss of the ark is not properly understood. Actually, it turns out that there is a huge mystery surrounding the disappearance of the Ark of the Covenant from ancient Israel.
Okay.
And doubly so, because it was the single most important object of Old Testament times. That's why it's the sign and the seal, because it's the sign and the seal of God's presence on earth. That's what it's considered to be, nothing less than that. The Temple of Solomon is built in Jerusalem around 950 before Christ, specifically as an house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord.
Really?
We know it stays there for hundreds of years afterwards. There are repeated accounts, but then round about 600s before Christ, the references become strange, and it sounds like they're mourning the loss of the Ark. And when the Babylonians invade Israel in 587 BC and steal everything from the temple, they don't find the Ark there. It's already gone by that point. And I have to cut a long story short here.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that the Ethiopian claim is extremely intriguing, because it turns out that a Jewish temple, exactly modeled on Solomon's temple, was built in Egypt, in Upper Egypt, near the modern city of Aswan, on an island called Elephantina.
No, it was not.
Missing from Jerusalem.
You want to correct something, Ion?
Yes. Aswan does not hold a replica of Solomon's temple, either one of them.
And he thinks he's referring to something that says
that
was copied.
Well, it's really convenient that it was done in Aswan, where they built the dam and flooded it. So it was real convenient for that's where that to be, so it'd be under 100 feet of water.
Right, okay, so he described the disappearance of the ark. That's true, as around the Babylonian captivity. He seemed at 570 or something, right? Okay, well, the dates may be wrong.
The storyline is great. The dates are just all screwy, yeah.
Right, but they... It did disappear after Babylonian destruction of the Second Temple. And
first
it sounds like
temple,
the...
Not Second Temple, First Temple.
The First Temple got destroyed, but the Levites knew it was happening, and they got out of there. Now, wait a minute. Where's Cleopatra? She's the one who takes it out of the First Temple.
She has the Levites take it out of the temple as payment for the money that she loaned Solomon to build the temple.
And that is the first temple we're talking about.
Yes, that is correct.
Right. So he tying it into the second, the Babylonian captivity 5-7, that's wrong. That's not relevant to your sense of
It turns out to make a long, long story short. Well, yeah, it makes a short story long and incorrect, but that's all right.
Okay.
But Ion, the first temple, that temple is built to house the Ark of the Covenant?
The only reason it was built.
And now they can't pay the debt on the temple, and so the Ark of the Covenant is removed from the temple, so the temple has no purpose now.
And that's how they burned the temple made out of stone. They burned the stone to the ground. Now go figure that one out.
If that happened, it did happen. You're saying it did happen, but it doesn't fit within our rationality.
Right.
So that's a good point, Ed.
We got the Pharaoh. We got the Pharaoh out of Giza, and then we're gonna burn the pyramid down. Well, good luck.
Oh. But they did burn the stone.
Yeah, but they didn't burn the Wailing Wall.
I know. So how you're saying there was a burning? Ion, you're saying, hey, wait, don't go off. You say there was a burning. Explain the anomaly to us.
Well, that's what we can't explain. We can't explain how you burn a brick building, a stone building.
Oh, so you're saying that's not what happened?
The Wailing Wall.
Yeah, see, Ion, you're mixing between what's reported and what happened and what didn't happen. Are you saying that in actual fact this temple didn't get burned?
Correct. It was destroyed. It wasn't burned.
But in the writings it says it's burned. That's what you're taking issue with. And so how was it destroyed?
They removed it block by block by block.
And where'd they put it? The blocks?
Well, some of the blocks were used to build the second temple, and then Herod used those torn asunder stones to build the last temple.
They built in the same area?
Same spot. Same foundation, Bob.
So all three Solomon's temples were built, and I recall you saying the first one was up in Asia Minor or someplace.
Well, that's where that is, Bob. That's because it wasn't in Israel then. That would have
been. Oh, okay. Right. The land has shifted.
Right. But the point is that the foundation of all those temples are still standing today. You can go pray at it if you want to. And yet, they basically collected everything that was of value when they pillaged it. The Ark of the Covenant went out, and the temple treasures went out, and then they went through, and everything that was of value they could haul, Cleopatra collected her debt. She basically repossessed it.
All the treasures in the temple besides the Ark.
Besides the Ark. And if there was a very, very intricate carving in stone that they could haul out, they toted that puppy out of there. They collected their debt.
Right. Why was Cleopatra so wealthy that she could fund these projects?
She was a marvelous creator, and she didn't put her power in a box.
Why did she take it then? Why did she even have concern for it?
Because the deal was broken. The rule was broken. She entered into an agreement.
Yeah, she was there. Look, they built this temple with the money I lent them, and they put a box in it, all useless. But now I'm stuck with carrying it around. Why didn't she just get rid of it, since she didn't respect?
Because of the power that they held in the box. Now that'll take you right back to the Baal story, if you pay close attention.
Oh, in other words, there was something. There was a power, and people died from it. That she had to acknowledge.
She was happy to acknowledge because it was hers. Why would she loan the money to build the temple in the first time? They even imported timbers from Lebanon, cedars from Lebanon. I mean, that'd be kind of like going, you know, let's build a temple. Okay, I think I would like to have it made out of pine trees that came from Egypt or from China. And imported the wood to build your temple out of. It's insane to think about the details that would have to go through of gathering up the materials to build all three of the temples. Even Herod's.
She she funded the creation of the Solomon's Temple because she valued the artifact and what it could do.
Well, she did, and she was trying to get busy with the whole process because she knew that power she could take advantage of, because these Hebrew lords was doing a great job at whooping everybody that crossed them up. So she's like,
oh, okay,
hey,
so it was a weapon.
I want to be buds with these folks.
even though personally she had her own power, but in other words, she got seduced by the new technology. This represents the new beginning of visual space and the boxing of reality, which led to our sciences. She couldn't help but be seduced by it.
Well, it wasn't seduced. She used it to her very best advantage, Bob.
Yeah, she was seduced by having it as a weapon.
Because what she did is she brought the power that was stolen from Egypt and then built a temple, and then what did she do with it? She brought it back to Egypt.
So the heart of the Jewish culture ended up back in Egypt.
Back into bondage.
Yeah, okay, great. Let's continue with the tape here.
Now, if all of the treasure is removed from the temple...
The temple treasure, yes.
This is not going to sit too well with those Knights Templars who are expecting to get their payment from all of the treasure that they think is in the temple.
Right, right.
Well, did the Knights Templars exist at the time of Cleopatra?
No, they most certainly did not.
I think Ion said...
No, but the story is that later, when the Knights Templars did exist, that they robbed the temple, and that's where their great wealth came from.
Mm-mm. They got theirs the old-timey way, Ed. They stole it.
Here's a fact. I mean, I remember when Ion says, I have that kind of mind, I can remember statements, and I collate it to what we're hearing today. Ion said many, 8 months ago to me, first there was Templardom, then there was Christendom, then there's going to be Iondom. So Templardom comes before Christendom, and Templardom, Ion said, they guarded the temples. They were the guards, I think, for the Solomon's temples.
There wasn't any treasure. They were just guarding the temple.
All right. So they're not... Did they call themselves Knights Templars because it wasn't a Christian context, or they did do it as Christians? Knight Templardom comes before Christendom?
Because it was in the same flow. It was the predecessor of Christian, of being Christ.
Right. It was that 400 years or so after the third Jesus, when Christianity has been not locked down in manuscript culture, sort of like during the, quote, Dark Ages, we say back then.
Well, it's even better than that, because Jesus wasn't even Christian, either one of them.
Right, right. So the Knights Templars were the guardians of the early Christian culture.
Temple.
Temple.
They didn't,
all right,
they didn't
so
they, do any religion. They didn't do, they still don't do religion. They just did... They just did their thing.
I got you. So they guarded the leftovers of the temples.
There wasn't anything left. They were just guarding it so nobody could see that there was no temple, that there were no treasures in the temple. That's what they.
Oh, and they so they encouraged the charisma of the temple. They kept the myth going.
Right, because then they could control all this power and this money and this treasure that they didn't have.
And we could quote, like, you have Constantine. He's about 300. He's about 300 years after Jesus. Now, maybe these years are wrong, but he seems to come after the third Jesus. And the Knight Templars are around during the time of Constantine.
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting, eh, Jim? I mean, Ed, you think of the Knights as starting with the Crusades, right? But we're talking
right.
700 years before.
Well, you can go right there to Istanbul, and you can see Constantine's chapel right there from the Blue Mosque, right across the way that he took over and made it the first Christian church in Turkey. Right.
So he adopted the cross, but the cross represented the Knights Templars, not the Christians.
Well, that was the Ankh.
Yeah, the Ankh, the cross. So he had the Ankh in his time.
Yep. Well, they yeah.
And
they
the Knights
all the way through. Yeah. Egypt.
So the Knights Templars had the Ankh as their symbol.
Yes.
Okay, so they were devotees of the tradition of Cleopatra. They respected what Cleopatra had preserved.
Yeah, it was all about the money.
And then exploited it. And beg your pardon?
It was all about the money checks, Bob. It still is. It hasn't changed.
Right, so they created this charisma around the myth of the Solomon's Temple, and that brought the money. Okay, that's pretty neat. So then, meanwhile, we're talking about the Ark. Where does the Ark go?
Well, we're not going to get ahead. It's on a barge leaving the
Broadway.
That's where we stay until you actually get some content.
Okay, recording.
At exactly the time that we begin to get hints that the Ark has gone missing from Jerusalem. And my suggestion is that the Ark was taken out of Jerusalem because at that time there sat on the throne of Israel a king who was regarded as a heretic and who had installed a pagan idol called an Asherah.
And that's a lot of gobbledygook, Greg.
No, what he's trying to tell you is that Cleopatra had collected her debt. And so they would never allow it. Well, they didn't have a choice. It wasn't theirs. The mortgage was due, and they didn't pay.
Right.
And so then it wasn't that things were added that were inappropriate. It was that the debt had to be paid, and so they had to pay up.
Yeah, he's saying that the priests were wise people who protected this legacy. And no, they were about to be evicted.
Well, they were employed by Cleopatra.
Very good. This is Opiuni what his story is made up of.
Right. Well, we could ask Elizabeth Taylor and see if she can confirm this.
Why? What's she got to do with it?
Well, she was Cleopatra in the movie.
Oh, that's right. You know. Right. Okay.
In the Holy of Holies of the temple, the loyal priests could never have allowed the Ark to stay in the presence of a pagan idol. I think they took it out, they took it to Egypt, they built a temple for it, they placed it there. 200 years later, and again, I'm cutting a long story very short, they were forced to flee from Egypt again. They couldn't flee north, they fled south, they followed the Nile River system. It brought them into Ethiopia around 400 before Christ. And there's extremely strong evidence that the Ark has been in Ethiopia ever since.
Yeah. I wouldn't agree with that. It has not been in Ethiopia for the last 2,500 years.
No, it has not.
No.
It was there for about a week as it was moving.
Wait, don't you like the authoritative way Ion is, Eddie? No, of course not. Just relax a minute. Hey, fine. Ed, let us humans just chuckle over this. It's like we're talking to God. We're finally getting the story.
But there may be an Ark in the Ethiopian church.
Yes.
The Carpathian Ark.
The one that they say it is, the one of Zion. Yes, okay, fine. But sports fans, let's get even better than that. If you came to any kind of conclusion that that was the case, are you joking? Everybody in the world would converge on that thing and take it apart, block by block by block. They'd nuke it or threaten to nuke it. They'd run a pipeline through it. They'd draw oil off of it. They'd do anything they had to do to get their hands on that super weapon. Ronald Reagan and his Star Wars spent billions to build Star Wars. All they have to do is go take over one little Zionist church in all of Ethiopia that the U.S. had been feeding for hundreds of years, to the point that they could get that magical thing that could make all the difference in every battle in all the world, the most powerful thing that's ever been, and it's held in one little cinder block church, a Zionist church, in the bowels of Ethiopia.
Well, good luck with trying to get that Ark, because it's guarded by that gentleman. He may be on his deathbed, but he's guarding it with his life.
Oh, okay, exactly,
So it's like the Carpathian Ark just had no good PR agent, just didn't have any charisma like the Jewish Ark.
Apparently, cancer's been around for a very long time, according to the Carpathians.
But it actually isn't, according to Ion.
Right.
It's new. So we're doing the Ark Goes Missing from Jerusalem and the Island of Elephantina, Ethiopian Jews, no rabbi. So just the last bit here.
So just the final part of the puzzle are the Ethiopian Jews, who are known as the Falashas or the Beta Israel, the House of Israel. And they practice a pre-Talmudic, purely Old Testament form of Judaism. They don't have rabbis.
Wait a minute.
Okay.
How do you get pre-Talmud before the books of Moses? We are confused.
Yeah, because their rabbis are from the beginning.
Right. And the books of Moses is where the Talmud began. So if you go pre-Talmudic, what is that?
He's calling them priests. Well,
So wait a minute now. If you're going to get before Abraham, how does that work?
Right. Now, why are there Jews in Ethiopia?
Well, that's very simple. They're scattered. They're everywhere. All you got to do is have your penis circumcised, and you can be converted. They're even in Manhattan, Bob. There's a lot of Jews in Manhattan, too. Why are there Jews in Manhattan? Well, they got tired of Ethiopia.
Okay, so the next topic, the Knights Templar look for the Ark of the Covenant. Now, we'll start off, did the Knights Templar ever have the Ark of the Covenant?
Never, never, never.
Okay, so they do look. So let's see what Graham says about this.
And the Knights Templar don't say they did either.
Right. Did they look for it?
Sure. They knew they were guarding the empty hole where it sat. So I guess they were looking around to see if it was in the basement.
So the Knights Templars, they didn't give a damn about the Ark of the Covenant, but they fed off the myth of it.
They controlled it. They had the Ark of the Covenant. They had the power. Well, if they had the power, then they were a superpower. Well, if they were a superpower, then they could guide people. They were robbing the stagecoaches as they was traveling through. And so then they were the robbers, and then they could charge vigorous to get your money deposited here and pick it up there for a fee. Well, they were the robbers and the bankers, the collectors on the other end, because they had all of the temple treasure, so therefore they could make their money checks good when they wrote the check to get them from A to B, because they were the ones robbing them on the way of the journey. So
Taliban and the CIA. So the Knights Templars rob people and then offer the protection. They're like the Jack Bowers phenomenon. They create the problem and then solve it, then create it and solve it.
Well, or the Hoffa version anyway.
Yeah, the Jimmy Hoffa. Very interesting. You ever heard of that before, Ed? The Knights Templars, half of them would rob the people and the other half would protect them, they split the take.
It was the same ones. You couldn't really tell the difference.
Well, what did the Knights Templars, how would they manifest their protective aspect? Or would they sort of, okay, we'll walk you to that corner down there, and then you're on your own?
No. They made it even easier than that, Bob. Because of this reign of terror where people was getting robbed because they didn't have the Federal Reserve to protect them, of course. They says, okay, go down here and see my buddy. And give him your money. And he'll give you a little piece of paper. And that piece of paper ain't worth nothing, but he'll give you a little piece of paper. And we have the Ark of the Covenant and all of the temple treasure. So therefore, we are a force to be reckoned with. So we will foresee.
We can back it up. We can back it up.
We can back up our piece of paper. Not to mention we've got your money, too. Then they'd get a piece of paper. They'd get down to wherever they was going. They'd present the piece of paper, and then they could get their money minus the fee.
Right.
Okay.
And then they'd get their money and go further on the journey and get robbed by the same people.
Well, exactly, pretty much. And or sometimes other folks that didn't solicit the full faith and backing of the FDIC, they would get the money, steal it on the way, and get to the bank down at the end of the trail, so they'd have the money sitting there ready for the next one that did pay the vigorous to get them from A to B. So either way, they're covered. 9 ways to Sunday.
So it seems that Western civilization, or maybe all civilization, is just the thugs versus the meek. I mean, the thugs have the gall to just rip off people, and the ones who don't feel very strong, can't box very well, they get ripped off.
Who will provide the grand design of what is yours and what is mine?
The local thug would do that.
Pretty much. I guess
okay,
they, didn't have, they weren't worried about the power in the box. Apparently they had their power in their pocket.
Right, so, yeah, and the thug is a guy who just takes his own power and knows that it's okay to beat up people because they just go to their bliss if they transition, so.
Oh, yeah, but they didn't thuggy. Kill him. They wanted him to hang around so they could make that journey again and pay him again.
Okay, so here's, let's see what Graham says about the knight.
When you say Solomon's Temple, what jumps out at me is in Freemasonry, they're always talking about the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple as an analogy for the building of the light body.
Would you agree that the... Okay, Ian, here's what I... The Freemasonry uses the building a temple as a metaphor for building a light body. Is that... The building light body, is that activating your parallel world traveling?
No.
Is that what it really referred to?
What is
yeah,
that?
Right. What is it? And why would you have to build it? Because you have the ability to parallel world, and they just activate it. Okay, so
right.
I can see
so
the...
So if you're smart enough to build a Masonic temple, you're smart enough to have the... Now, Bob, be careful. You're going to get into all of that bond and Freemasonry with the square.
Yeah.
Remember you went about 2 weeks figuring out the plumb bob and the square?
Not 2 weeks, about one or two sessions. No, he said not
well,
2 weeks.
Okay. Felt like 2 weeks, but for all those of what was plumb and square and how you build
yeah.
the master stone and the cornerstone and the power to do a...
You can hear a bit of that free Masonic history on the dreaming tapes we offer, the dreams,
yes,
dreaming
indeed.
Series.
Yes, indeed. Or I guess they want us to do it again and again and again, or maybe even save a few hundred hours and they could enjoy what you've already done, so... Please yourself, everybody. It's available if you're interested. Now,
yeah.
The,
okay.
The pull of this, the pull of this part becomes with Tank. They're actually comparing Freemasonry with Knights Templars, and they the more they're light years away from each other.
Right.
That's a
okay.
whole other thing.
And the, yeah, the Freemasons did. The Freemasons did start around the time of the printing press.
Well, it'd be like comparing Henry VIII's church with the Catholic Church. They both had a god, but they weren't the same ones.
Okay, was the Freemasons more aligned with the Christian god, or not at all?
We can't tell, but we can tell. You can't tell. You
but the Knights Templar, they didn't... They, right, but the Knights Templar don't connect to the Christian god.
Exactly.
Okay, here we go.
So if Solomon's Temple was where the Ark of the Covenant had been stored, then what is the relationship between that and Masonic lore and history?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, the Freemasons trace their origins back to Hiram Abiff, to the original builder, the architect of Solomon's Temple.
Now, they apparently do that. And why do they trace themselves back to that?
Well, because that's the whole point, that they were supposed to be the murderer. The murder takes place, and that's the rite, the shrine.
Right, so it's a story.
They
use that
story that they adopted to give them the same story that the Knights Templars used, because if they were the original architects of the archetype that built Solomon's Temple for Crypt Pete's sake, they'd be pretty marvelous, powerful creators, don't you think?
Yeah, so they put on the mythology of the Knights Templar. They adopted it to themselves.
And they say, and they you ask them, that's a ritual. It's only a ritual. It's only a ritual. Doesn't mean that's what it was. Doesn't mean that's what happened. Doesn't mean that's how it started. And if it did and it was, then it would be, and then they'd all have to be Jewish. And you ask
right,
a,
so
a
that,
Mason if they're Jewish, and they'll tell you right quick, no. Oh, but then Laman is the one that gets licked out of it, and apparently he wasn't Jewish either then, I guess. Interesting.
Right, so here we go.
You keep going with this story, you're going to start to question the wisdom, aren't you?
The question what? You blipped out.
If you keep going with this storyline, you'll soon be questioning the wisdom of Solomon.
Okay.
There's an extremely interesting track and line to follow there. And that line, curiously, through the Masons, leads us to the Knights Templar.
Right. He's got all that backwards, according to Ion. You don't, unless you're leading backwards, but he's connecting Freemasons and Knights Templars, and you're saying there's no connection. Okay, gotcha.
Templars were before the Masons.
That's right. So it's like we have Ion here, who's a new monk that's been hanging around his church of Dobbstown, and maybe you might want to interview Ion to find out his story about the Zion history, or its story. You get what I mean, eh, Ed? You're getting this. Here we go.
And that was also a feature of my study in the Sign of the Seal, because I found evidence that when the Knights Templar rose to power, and we're talking the late 1100s after Christ.
Mm-hmm. He's saying the Knights Templars begin around the Crusades, the first Crusades, 1100 AD. That's what people think the Knights Templars are. You're telling us the Knights Templar existed 2,000 years before 1100 AD.
How was it that they're supposedly watching after the original Solomon's Temple, it being in 1100 VD, BC, DD, EE? How do you get there from there? I mean, if it's been gone for 400 years before 1100, why were they at? How did they get it if it's been lost for 400 years? If they're the ones supposedly that had it.
Yeah.
That their primary mission in Jerusalem was not to protect pilgrims on the road between the coast and the city of Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
but actually to search for the Ark of the Covenant. They took possession of the Temple Mount, where the Temple of Solomon had stood until it was destroyed by the Babylonians. And they carried out excavations there. And then, again, too much detail to go into here, but I believe they encountered an Ethiopian prince exiled in Jerusalem called Lalibela, and returned to Ethiopia with him. And I found Templar crosses all over some of the sacred places of Ethiopia, an extraordinary group of churches at Lalibela, hewn out of solid rock.
And just before you speak, Ed, this sounds like the kind of thinking that's done in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail books. Maybe this is a tendency of British journalists to make little connections out of puny fabric. Just accepting what you're saying or believing what you're saying, it really becomes clear the limitations of what Hancock is talking about. If we accept the premises of Ion, it clears up the confusion that Graham is wallowing around in.
Well, but the Ox came from way even before. They're talking about these symbols, which were Egyptian, for Pete's sake, why would they not be there? The Ankh that they're talking about is that whole Zionist world anyway. So it'd be like saying we found sand on the beach, so this must be Hebrew.
Is the Ankh part of the Carpathian culture?
Yes.
I wonder if Curtis Davis and the guys over at the Occult Radio Science Project, where they interviewed us, they're into the ancient Egyptian thing, and I wonder if they know the Ankh comes from Carpathia. Is it known? Do scholars know that the Ankh comes from Carpathia?
Yeah.
Okay.
That I believe the Templars were involved in constructing. So somehow that Masonic Templar theme that goes right back to Solomon's Temple follows the Ark into Ethiopia as well.
Well, this can't just be, I mean, a skeptic could say, well, maybe they have this, maybe the stones are radioactive or something, but if you're describing this object, this golden wooden object, levitating and lightning bolts shooting out of it, wouldn't it be that the radiation might be a side effect of some advanced technology?
I honestly believe if I were asked to place a bet on this.
Okay.
My bet would be that the Ark of the Covenant is an out of place artifact. It is a piece of technology. It's a piece of high technology.
Now, I do agree with that, Ion, that it's a leftover from an atomic age. It's radioactive. The Ark of the Covenant.
There is no radio frequency that comes from the Ark, even now. It is magically imbued with the human creator's power, and that's more powerful than any atomic bomb that you come up with, past, present, or future. And the proof of that is when they bombed Hiroshima, it didn't kill them all. So some human creators even survived that. So, c'est la guerre. There is power, but the power comes from the humans, not from some ancient Samaritan Hebrewoids.
Right. So when you were describing how the Ark was used by the Jews to slay whole armies, those armies that died, everybody died.
Right.
In those armies, not just, you know, two-thirds. So
everybody.
Right. So they're saying that Hancock is saying and Wilcock are saying that they would bet on the idea that the Ark of the Covenant is an artifact from another era, not associated with the primitive times back then. It was a high-tech object. You're saying you're diminishing it if you call it a high-tech. It's way more powerful than a high-tech object.
Right. It's so powerful.
And is it
so powerful? Wait, now, it's so powerful, it kills the opposing army, but doesn't kill the Hebrew army.
Right, now, if I encountered the Ark of the Covenant, I could die.
Does
it still have that power? Yeah, if we had a rule. If we had a rule, but not many people know about it, so if they encountered it, they wouldn't get the effect because they didn't know anything about the history of it.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
I trace that back through the lineage of ancient Egypt. The objects like the Ark of the Covenant are found in other Egyptian traditions.
So to trace the Ark of the Covenant back to Egypt is accurate if you know the Cleopatra story.
Absolutely.
But it's not connected to Freemasonry or the Knights Templars. It's Cleopatra.
Yeah, exactly. Who was the first Freemason, Bob?
Francis Bacon.
All right. Was he around with Solomon's Temple?
No.
Well, all right then.
It's like the Knights Templars were medieval manuscript era mafia. The Freemasons, with the British Empire riding on the new science of Bacon, ride in on the printed book effect, which gave, you know, England, the Protestant Church, more power than the Catholic Church eventually. So the Freemasons are a product of the printing press, and they have as their content, their ritual content, is all this previous manuscript mythology of the Knights Templars going back to Egypt. That's the content of their printed book.
Absolutely, and Bacon was kind of famous for bringing in that whole flow with the Renaissance and that whole flow of what you call the Illuminati anyway, wasn't it?
Right, and you call that the Dark Ages, from King James's Bible up to 1900, up to the Electric Age, is the not including Electric Age.
We just love Mary's Boy.
Mary's Boy?
Yeah.
And who's that? Who's Mary's Boy?
King James.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, so now we're on to Moses groomed to be a pharaoh and master of Egyptian magic. Just on
law. Egypt was once my home. I was a slave. Sin sick and like did roam. Love like did crave. Yes, good.
All right. The academics, the official archaeologists or people, scholars who might study the Ark of the Covenant in acceptable university setting, what arguments would they come up with to make fun of Hancock's fringe arguments?
Well, they probably wouldn't, because there's nothing empirical to reference it on, so science says it didn't exist.
Right, gotcha. Okay, so you're
it, can't use it, can't get no good out of it. Nobody living got any good out of it. Nobody even wrote it down as a reference point that got any good out of it. Everybody that did write it down was a different faith or religion or sect or group or whatever they were. So then it was the Babylonians and the Samaritans and the, oh, and don't even forget the Ottomans now. The Ottomans had been jumping right in there. And the Moabites was all over the place and the Canaanites. Paul, there's just worlds of them piled in there. So the scientists wouldn't have this for 2.3 seconds at anybody's level or degree because they'd say, we don't have faith, we have science. So the faith that you're describing is outside the bounds of fact. Just the facts, ma'am. Remember Mr. Friday? Mr. Friday,
yeah.
Just the facts, ma'am. That's all he wants, the facts. Well, science ain't gonna have it because there ain't no facts. There's no place where it rested. There's not even them brush arbors where they stored it. They don't even have the temple to see where it set. None of them. They don't even have, they have drawings, renditions, but they weren't from anybody that was there at that day, you see. Cleopatra,
okay, got
you.
Got it. That's enough. We got it. The next one, Moses gloomed to be a pharaoh master of Egyptian magic. Here we go.
The objects like the Ark of the Covenant are found in other Egyptian traditions. And Moses,
mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that Moses, who's the guy who climbs Mount Sinai and receives the tablets of stone from God and who is given the blueprint of the Ark, which he then passes down to builders to make for him,
I see.
That Moses is reared in the household of the pharaoh. He is groomed as a future pharaoh of Egypt.
Mm.
Now, he breaks away from that, but to be groomed as a pharaoh is no light thing. It means that Moses would have been a master of Egyptian magic.
Ion, was Moses a master of Egyptian magic?
Well, of course he was.
Okay.
Of course he was.
What?
Remember the story when Miriam got
out
of the bull rushes?
Right, okay, so is a master of, is Egyptian magic including knowledge of parallel world traveling in your METAC?
Yes, and turning your staff into serpents and the call. See, Pharaoh was a god, so he got introduced, Moses got introduced to how to be a god in your own METAC. Remember, this was pre-separation.
Now it's in pre-separation, but, oh, that's right, it's before the Ark. You're right, get you. That's
exactly.
Right.
Exactly, and that's why we went through that whole big gobbledygooky thing, so you could squeeze the lemon, so you can now go, okay, got it, good.
Right, it's like last week when I was celebrating me and Connie's 40th wedding anniversary, I said we will be seen as the last great married couple. Moses was the last great take his own power person before the effect of the fall of man.
Correct. And even then came back and he was groomed to be a god. Pharaoh was God. Well, guess what? He's the one that stood right in Pharaoh's face, said, let my people go or we will.
Where did Moses get the idea of a different god than the Pharaoh's god?
Oh, that was because he was off, when he run off and left. When he run off and...
Oh, when he murdered somebody. When he murdered somebody.
He murdered the taskmaster, and he run
right.
off, and that's where he found his wife, and they had a different belief. Now, where were they from? Moab. Moabite.
That gets into the powerful Moab culture.
There you go. And then they got in there, and they started picking a wife, and he was kind of like there was lots of sisters to choose from. And they was rolling along there, and all of a sudden he got to learning what their religion was about. There,
but it was all religions back then emphasized taking your own power. So the Moab religion might have been similar to the Pharaoh's religion.
Not so. Yes, but more of the land girl version of it. You see, the Moabites weren't into all the big temples and all that kind of business. It was about take care of the land, and then it'll take care of you, kind of thing, and that benefit.
Right, and also maybe it had less gods, less deities.
Well, less deities that were more powerful. That's where Moses found out about Mount Sinai the first time, because his wife said, look at that. Moses says, honey, what in the world is that? And he says, oh, that's where God stays. What do you mean? You see the fire in the top of Mount Sinai? And he'd say, wow, I see it. It looks like a big old fire. The mountain's on top of fire through the clouds. Well, that's where the Holy of Holies is. And then,
right,
oh,
so the, Ion, you have talked about the importance of the Moabites, and you posted a lot on our Dupes of Non-Physical thing on the Moabites, but you're saying, and what's the name of Moses' wife?
Moses' wife, well, now, he had two wives. He had two wives.
Okay.
She was known as, her actual name was Ishi.
Ishi?
Ishi.
And then that was the first wife that he learned about Moabism from.
The first, yes, that's correct. And then Moses' half-brother would have been Aaron. And then,
right.
then her Christian name changed. But
who's her? You don't specify. Are you talking about Ishi?
Yes, her name. But the Christian name that they give in the scriptures is different. It's not correct, so we're not going to use it. But you can look up your Christian reference to give her name.
You mean what's written down is incorrect?
Correct.
Did she have a Christian name? I guess not.
No.
She didn't have one.
She was Moabite. She wasn't going to have a Christian name.
Who put the Christian name in? The Council of Nicaea?
The Council of Nicaea in 25, that's exactly.
And right. And the Torah, the writers of the Bible before the Old Testament put in the Hebrew name?
But she didn't have a Hebrew name. She was Moabite.
Is it said in the Bible that she's a Moabite?
Yes.
Okay, so it's known. Now, so Moses was influenced by the Moabite culture, and he took that back to Cairo, is it? Is that where he is when he goes back to Egypt? Is he in Cairo? Is that the main capital, main power place there?
No. It would not quite be Cairo, because Cairo was just a sidebar. This would have been from the edge of, it would have been closer, to Alexandria.
Oh, okay. Because, all right, so that's another topic, Alexander. So he argues, you have, so Moses, you have Abraham already, you got Hebrew culture, but Moses brings in the Moabite tradition and makes a different kind of Hebrew culture. Or can you say the Moabites over-influenced Abraham and the Hebrews before Moses?
It was I would say a wash.
Oh, okay, so he tapped into one of the...
Sure as you say it one way or the other, then you find out there's another reference that hooks that all back together.
And you telling us that? What is the reference? That would be the Sumerians.
Well, right, and then this one tells that one, and that one tells this one, and it kind of they all be crisscrossed up, is what we're trying to say.
Right, but you say there is a unifying underlying point.
Well,
and
just
that
they all got mixed together.
From the original Samaritan influence.
Yes.
Or Samaritan or Sumerian?
Samaritan.
Okay. That's why you use the phrase Samaritan Hebrewoid.
That's correct.
Right, so Moses gets some Samaritan Hebrewoid Moabite wisdom when he's an outlaw, then comes back and builds a case against the Egyptian magic with that Moabite influence. That is not discussed, is it, in the Bible? I mean, that's left out, right?
Right.
That's interesting. Okay, so
he would have known Hekau, everything that the Egyptians knew about magic.
He knew the Egyptian magic, but he felt more empowered when he encountered his first wife's culture, right? He got more empowered by them than he did with Egyptian magic?
Yes. Well, but now some of that came from... Now, you do know Moses also had a black wife.
Okay. I don't know nothing about anything of this stuff, so... Yeah, okay, I accept that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want her name?
Yeah.
Okay. Jane Hakota.
And that was after, what happened to Ishii? Ishii.
That was before.
Oh, yeah, black wife first. In right. Egypt, in Alexandria suburb. Right, okay, so that's the Egyptian thing, and that would be what a lot of African Americans identify with, the black aspect of Egyptian
life.
Well,
see, that she was Cushite.
Cush, K-U-S, K-U-S-H.
No, C-U-S-H-I-T-E, Cushite.
And where were they from?
Well,
were they part of Egypt?
Yes.
Okay. So, anyways, that would be the African thread in Egyptian culture.
The Ethiopian, yes.
The Ethiopian aspect. So she was an Ethiopian, not necessarily.
Yes.
Just
no,
okay.
She was Ethiopian.
How did she feel when he murdered? Because I assume she was with him when he murdered whoever he murdered.
No, that was yes. No. See, there you go. It's this whole time chain thing. She was in Egypt, but didn't flee with him. He left there single, but very quickly took her as a wife in his while he was roaming around before he found. Now, the Christian name of the final wife, now we're talking about, you're talking about Jethro's, that would be the father of the Christian name would have been Zipporah.
Right. So Moses, when he was on the run, he was with his black wife.
Right.
And what happened to her that allowed him to, or he had both wives at the same time?
No. They got crossed. It didn't work out. They split the
right, so she left, and then he finds the Ishaite. Moab. Okay, so you have this. Okay, so we're doing
now
the Moab thing.
Your scriptures talk about that, but that's referenced in Numbers.
Okay, in a section called Numbers. All right, here we go.
And I believe that incorporated into the ancient Egyptian system, it was first of all a powerful belief in magic and the
mm-hmm.
powers of magic, not superstition, but as a practical thing, a practical skill, a power that can be used in the world.
What does he think is practical magic as opposed to what the Egyptians thought was practical magic? What is the word magic referring to?
We have no idea unless he's making the point. I mean, we certainly can't validate the Cox's view, but if we can stretch it, and this is where it would be kind, because Ed would say, well, okay, we'll give a little leeway here. If you're calling anything that you're calling magic is a power you don't understand, it's magic, if that's what you want to call it, and so anything you don't get is magical, so that's just from your limitation. But if it's not magical, if you know how it works, it's no longer magic, you see?
Yeah, so the phrase practical magic is an oxymoron or a contradiction.
Yeah. I mean, but see, that comes right back to the whole place of getting from Exodus 18:2, where you get Moses hooked up with his wife, when in the Numbers list the Ethiopian wife on the flip side. So they would actually cross it up. But the Ethiopian wife came first, and then Zipporah, which is now, that's not her name, but that's, let's say it this way, that is Jethro's daughter, Zipporah. That's not what her real name was. That was the Christian rendition of it.
Okay, so when here's Moses is schooled as he grows up in Egyptian religion. He has his own power. He's getting his godhood. Then he kills somebody and runs off. Does he lose his power for a while?
No, never.
On the run?
Never. Now, wait a minute now. Here's a critical link that you've missed. And we want to make sure, because they brought it up, so we're not going to let it go. We normally would wait for ever how long it took you to ask the question. Now, which tribe was Moses from?
I don't know.
He was, his daddy was Amron.
Okay.
Okay. That's who Moses' daddy was. That's spelled A-M-R-A-M, Amram.
That was that particular tribe.
Well, no.
That was one of the 13 tribes?
Well, no, I'm going to tell you, but we want to give the reference so when people can go back and go, it's a bunch of gobbledygook. No, we're going to give it to you straight so you can get it. And his and Amron's wife was Jochebed. Okay? And guess what she was?
A Moabite?
She was a Levite. And we're talking about Moses' mama and daddy now.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so she
Moses, she was a Levite. So that, guess what that did? That made Moses a Levite.
What was Amram a tribe of? Member of what tribe?
Well, just different. It just doesn't, you don't, it never references, but his wife was a Levite.
Okay, there's the 12 or 13 tribes of Israel or of Hebrew culture. That's, well, those are established before Moses.
Of course.
Okay, so Amram is one of the 12. I'm just, and you know, Zephram and Manasseh.
No, Amram is not a tribe. The Levite woman married a Jewish man but was not listed in a tribe. It doesn't say. Never referenced.
You asked what tribe Moses was of, and you're saying he was a Levite.
That's correct, and that's significant because of the Ark of the Covenant. Moses
so
he would have the power to handle the power of the box.
Right, even before the box shows up. I mean, he's ready for the box when it shows up. He can survive
it. That's correct, and he knew of the bones of Joseph already anyway.
Yeah, in other words, other Israeli or Hebrew tribes may not have known what the Levite tribe knew.
That is correct.
Right. Okay. So the Levites were the Illuminati of the Hebrew culture.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's interesting. Okay, back to the...
And secondly, that this often manifested in the form of boxes, which were carried on poles, and which contained a powerful object.
I wonder, this word object triggers me. I've been meaning to say for the last 2 hours that, you know, Moses presenting his artifacts, the rod that turned into a snake and all that, and the Pharaoh had his artifacts. This battle of objects is the battle of power in the pre-writing cultures. The pre-writing cultures would have objects.
Now we say yes, except for Midian. Because you see, the Moabites, that would be found in the place of Midian, and they were the first ones to do the recording. The Midianites were the first ones to do any level of recording that didn't stand. Everybody else that, like Egypt, recorded stuff, you can still find it. Babylonians recorded stuff, you can still find it. Midian, nothing written from the Midianites, and that's who Moses' family was from the Moabite side, from where Mount Sinai is, was the Midians, and nothing is recorded. Now, some say that the Dead Sea Scrolls came from the Midianites, but now that's conjecture that even human creators can't quite embrace. But you don't.
Well, do you embrace that? Do you say that Dead Sea Scrolls are from the Midianites?
No, we don't. We don't.
No. Okay.
But it's significant because that would be your first recordable. That'd be the first writing that is evaporated.
And they understood. They understood the effects of writing and canceled it by throwing it away.
Basically, that's exactly right, and that would be your McLuhan point of the hour. But see, when you get into Midian and the Moabites, when you get that, if you get that well overlaid, all this other stuff that you're bringing, the points that are valid now. We're not saying they're not valid, but it takes a whole lot of wind out of the sails because it's all predicated on something else that already is. Most of the dynamics that are being addressed are because of something else that's been overlaid already.
Overlaid and missed and not seen.
Well, exactly. But see, that's why you have to bust it up and divide it the way you have to do. But see, you can't take the Talmud, you can't take the Torah, you can't take the books of Moses and write it just any crazy way you want to. And then you go, and then Bob says, oh, but they certainly have, and they certainly do. And we can't fault you or say, no, Bob, you're not correct, because you really, really, really are.
Yeah, but based on the given text, but there's all this
exactly.
other stuff that, which is what James Joyce was trying to point out with Finnegan's Wake. We're doing an etymology or philology of culture here.
Precisely.
So the Median writing.
We should write a new book and say Finnegan is awake instead of Finnegan's Wake.
Right. No, that's part of the meaning in Finnegan's Wake. Remember, it's not apostrophe S. It's Finnegan's, Finnegan's Wake. You can put all kinds of different interpretations.
Finnegan's Awake.
Oh yeah, that's included. That's included.
Yeah.
But the word media, it's not media, M-E-D-I-A, which was a Middle Eastern area, you know, around the time of Macedonia and that. That's not the Midianites. Media is M-I-D-I-A.
Right.
Yeah, but it's pretty close to the word media. And for most people, the word media means, that McLuhan popularized, means electric post-book culture. That you could say a book is media, but people think of it as transit, transparent, and transit, transient information exchange and melting away all the time is our world of media. And you're saying, or media, but media was the only writing culture that did not create the fall, because it did not preserve its writing.
It would be pre-printing press, but it would be information flow. It would be information flow that they figured out wasn't serving them, and they got shit of it.
They got shit of it? Yeah. Yeah,
they're recording.
Yeah, they'd write it down and use it, and then after all, they'd say, no, this complicates. This is like texting or email. It gets everything all garbled. Let's just go back to speech.
Typing? You mean if we just keep typing? Well, what in the hell good is all this? We'll do a funny side story. We can't stand it just because we've got to lighten this up just for a second. It's about like Betty White was hosting Saturday Night Live, and the reason that she was the largest viewing audience that they've ever had was because they had a campaign on Facebook for Betty White to host Saturday Night Live. Well, she gets on the thing and says, I must thank everybody from Facebook. That's why I'm here hosting Saturday Night Live. And before they called me, I didn't know what Facebook was. Didn't know what it was, but because of this Facebook thing, I'm now hosting Saturday Night Live. And now that I have thoroughly researched and studied what Facebook is, I want to thank you all for getting me on the show. And what I know about Facebook is it's an incredible waste of time.
That's a That's the appropriately Midianite philosophy.
That's Midianite philosophy. Exactly right. Very good, Bob. Typically that would sent you down the rabbit hole, but that's good.
No, I got that one. Yeah,
Thank you. I got it.
We're Midianites. Yeah, we do we do that on our show. We say all this profound stuff, and then we say we're not really effective. effective stuff. Can we say we're Midianites? Are they Midianites or Midianites? What are they?
No, Midianites.
Midianites. We're a Midianite show. Well, we got a new one, Ed, for Wednesday.
Like a MIDI player, you know, the MIDI sound players, like a Midianites.
Yeah, there was a mini skirt, and then there was the MIDI skirt.
That's exactly right. That's good. That's good.
So, the MIDI night philosophy.
Now, Ed, you can't. See, we'll treat you so many ways, you're bound to like some of them, huh, Ed?
Exactly.
This is great. We do a show, and then people ask us, well, we don't remember what we said. That was yesterday. You guys study it. We're moving on.
We do take great deference with Zipporah, which is the name they give for Jethro's daughter. That is not what she was known as. but we don't want to undo it because, see, you want to stay with the meme because that's what's sort of been written down, so that's the meme.
Yeah, work with the false premise.
That is. We will work with just so they can have the reference point. But the Zipporah is not what Jethro named his daughter.
Right. So, what was it about the Midianites that they were clued into to a race? You know, McLuhan used to quote Master Eichhart, who lived around 1300, 1400. His famous aphorism was, only the hand that erases writes the true thing.
Well, the erasing is the always redefining. Erasing is a mistake that you correct, or you have another thought that replaces that thought. Now, we're not going to be a proponent at this point because we don't want to beat Jesus' time because he was just trying to validate Marshall McLuhan. So we'll be easy with it. But that erasing point that Eichhart's trying to make is that you have the propensity for a new overlaying thought. So you can replace that with a new thought, and that's the erasure. That's the erasing. If you look up the word erasing, you are replacing.
No, really good. And that, in other words, the Midianites realized that writing screwed up the 3-2-1 process.
So I guess the Midianites' role in what you call history was to validate Eichhart's point, which vindicated Marshall McLuhan's reality, which solidified James Joyce's confusion.
That was a very accurate, precise statement. I agree with every word you said there. That was perfect.
Oh, my. Ed, we're in trouble. Yeah, Ed,
we better erase that one. Let's erase that quickly.
We got trouble in River City, and it begins with
the
P and rhymes with
P,
and that's the end for pool.
Yes, the image of suburbia in America, you know, in the 50s, 60s was the kid would bring home a transistor radio or cigarettes or beer, and the parents would get mad and throw the stuff out and tell them to get back to the books and get back to your schoolwork. Well, the media did the opposite. If a kid brought home some paper, he'd be spanked or disciplined. We don't want any of that permanent paper around here. Get that transistor radio going again.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah.
Let's go see if we can get cuddle up with some of these goats out here. That'll be more fun.
Yeah, that's like that guy in the Squidbillies episode where he's trying to kill Dean Koontz because he's a writer. That Squidbilly guy is a Midian. He's a Midianite.
Earl Kyler.
Yeah, he tries to assassinate the book people. The Squidbillies are Midianites.
Yeah. Don't never That's, not no never do no reedy booky wordy word thing something. Ain't nothing never no good never come out of no books. They got a lot of Ion, you know, but the new season is full of Ion. It is just raging with it.
Do you know how they know of Ion? The writers, the creators? How do they know about it?
William Street, not very far.
What street?
Williams Street.
Is that in Atlanta?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in Atlanta. Okay.
Listen, they can even pick up a Chief Radio way over there. From Los Angeles, it's everywhere.
Okay, here we go. This is the continuing of the Cox.
Very good.
So I think the Ark is one of a category of objects that we can trace back in ancient Egypt. Now, the people who could build the pyramids, who could move gigantic blocks of stone weighing hundreds of tons as though they weighed no more than a feather, those ancient Egyptians clearly could do a lot of things that we can't do today.
Yeah.
And I think they had, where they got it from, I don't go there.
But I do. We do.
We do go there, right?
We go there. It's so simple. When you're a marvelous human creator and you're in your power, can be, do, or have anything, You have no limitation. You have no degradation. You have no position that eliminates you from your capacity of creation. All you have to do is speak to the stones, and the stones will move. And if you don't come into your power long enough, the stones are going to cry out, glory and honor. Just stand and you watch. As these people, human creators, start coming to their power and the winds and the waves obey their will, here's what you better know, and you better figure out real fast, because if you don't, it'll roll you over. You need to know this if you choose to. As you come into your power and you watch others around you that figure this stuff out and come into their place of power, that's when everything's going to change. That's when everything's going to change. That's when things are going to start shuffling, and that's what's going to cause your mass exodus, as we talked about before, because it's going to be so far beyond what you know that you know that you're not going to, it's going to be the fastest path you're going not to hang around. Now, you're talking about how the they didn't say who the original architect was for all of that building in Egypt, and we've already said real plain that was Moses. Moses. Nobody, that gets them all crossways because they don't get it, but that's all right. They can if they want to. But the whole point
Ian, just the in Freemasonry they talk about Hiram the architect. If he was the archetypal architect, I don't know if he was, let's assume he was, they're really talking about Moses. So Freemasonry is referring to Moses if they're talking about the original great architect in Egypt.
Yeah, but get it, but him up a free, a bond mason or a Freemason, bond them up in their guild, supposedly, and make it be all about Moses, or you make it all be about that they have to be Jews, and you're going to be having a way different conversation, aren't you?
Yeah, so the problem
they
that distance
themselves from Jewish.
Right. Who distances themselves? Who does?
The Masons.
Oh, okay, gotcha, right. Even though they're Moses, you could say he was Jewish because he came from the Moabites.
He was a Levi. He was a
Levi. Right, okay. But he had the Moabite strain in him. Right, but he was a Levite. Okay, so here's you're saying that the Freemasons distance themselves from the Jews, but they don't know they're actually referring with the metaphor of Hiram to the original architect Moses.
Absolutely.
Who was Jewish. Yeah.
But they Solomon's temple that they were responsible for building, but they don't even acknowledge Solomon as Jew.
Who's they? Who does the Freemasons?
The Masons, right.
Yeah, but he was. So the Freemasons got a little tangled up there.
He was not just a Jew, he was the king of the Jews.
Yeah. So Graham Hancock here, his problem is he's a bookman. And he's creating all these limitations for his view of things through the fact that he's trying to write a book.
Oh.
So he's talking about Egyptian magic, and McLuhan used to point this out, that the writer celebrates the oral, and the oral is super impressed with the writing, with the writer. So here you have Hancock celebrating oral Egyptian magical culture, but he's trying to do it through the book medium, and that's not going to work.
Right. And if he'd just done it like the cereal maker, then it could be like Lucky Charms. It could just be magically delicious.
Okay, so here's the next.
I don't speculate, but I do argue that they were the masters of a sacred technology, a kind of magic, and that this was manifested in the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant was taken out of that system and carried off to Israel, but it continued to be a powerful object.
So you talk about sacred technology.
What does the Ark of the Covenant have to do with the building of the Egypt?
Yeah, he says that the Ark of the Covenant represented the Egyptian magic. Yeah, I mean, it's not. So he's mixing these illiterate men.
How do you get there from there is what we don't get.
Well, you get there from there if you don't know what you're talking about and you're going by other writings.
Okay. Touché. Fair enough. We just want to make sure we were being clear there.
Yeah, what's interesting is that he's saying that the content of the Ark is a reference to sacred technology. And to say that a technology...
power.
Right, but to say anything is sacred, you lose the power of ascending and erasing.
You limit it, yes.
You limit it to the sacred.
You limit it to the end-all, be-all of how you are separated eternally from your power.
Yeah, Ed, I think we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. We're beginning to see how silly this whole enterprise of talking about Antarctic work is. We'll participate. So the last one is the Ark is the power of God.
I mean, it seems like if the Knight Templars are spending that much manpower and time and resources searching for this Ark.
So they're missing the point that the Knights always protected the Ark, but the Ark wasn't there, but they put on the mythology of the Ark.
They protected the building that stored the Ark.
they weren't searching. They didn't want the Ark. They were into the outer garment.
Well, but because they weren't Levi, it would have destroyed them. If they spent all this time and energy and power looking for it, they better find some Levites to handle it, or they'll be tangled up because of the rules and the regulations. It wouldn't have served them very well to steal it and then get them be melted right there where they stood.
Yeah, I remember when I first started, when I first met J.W., he kept telling me, "Bob, I'm looking for some Levites. Are you a Levite, Bob?" Okay, so the Ark is a... Okay, so I didn't seem to... No, I did finish that. So I just... The word sacred technology is like sacred geometry. It's a bugaboo in itself. Okay, it's like if you're... That line, those who know don't teach, and those who don't know teach. Well, those who understand the sacred would avoid sacred technology to the utmost.
Precisely.
Same point, right? You get it?
It would be limiting, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's only sacred. I mean, what's... So, yeah.
Which is scared if you change the letters around a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sacred
is
scared.
It's sacred. It's because we can't explain it. We're not going to explain it. If we could explain it, you wouldn't get it. So let's just leave. Let's let science have it, and we'll just leave it in the sacred column. That's good. And then if we get real confused, we can always become a good Zionist and go to Ethiopia and get it all figured out for us. Not get cancer, but we can get it all figured out.
Okay. Carol liked that one. Okay, so... She just came walking by with giggling. Okay, I'll just do this again. The Ark is the power of God.
I mean, it seems like if the Knight Templars are spending that much manpower and time and resources searching for this Ark, that they must have felt that if they had possession of it, that they would gain some really important capabilities by possessing it.
Yes, I think they absolutely did feel that.
So
think,
what might those capabilities be?
This is the power of God.
Defense system?
First and foremost, within their system of ideas, and indeed within the system of ideas of the religion of Israel, this is the power of God.
So the Knight Templars understood and were not victims of the fall of man. They put on, they exploited those that were looking for the answer to the fall of man. And the fall of man comes in with the idea of the external God, represented by the veil and separateness in the Ark. I'm assuming the Knights Templars were the exact opposite of what they were saying. They would have nothing to do with the power of God. They just exploited it. You
right.
agree with me? You understand?
But, the point, though, is that the Ark of the Covenant was the representation of the power of God on the earth. And we say in that particular inference, yes, it is exactly that, because human creators voided themselves of their own power and magically, that's the word that seems to be the big word of the day, the magic word of the day, but they imbued their power into this box. So into this box was the power of God imbued. Yes. So is it a very powerful box? Yes. Is it been separated by a veil? Yes. Has the veil been rent in two? Yes. is that veil now lifting or thinning to the point that that flow of power is coming into human creators? Yes, are some human creators embracing this place of power and activating it and having marvelous, wonderful, powerful experiences being wrought into their life? Yes. How many sessions have you had, Bob, with folks that they get through and they get their place of power, and the next thing you know, you get the electronic mail that says, Ion has changed my life. I've been empowered. I've been activated. Things are happening. I didn't even know what I was asking, and I had all kinds of fun experiences, and sometimes my world got perfect, and sometimes my world went awry, but it all got cleaned up quickly because I found my place of power. That's what this is about. So those words aren't incorrect. They just have a sad application.
Yeah, they're pointed in the opposite direction.
Pretty much.
In the erroneous direction.
Yeah,
but all that you just...
You can't get it wrong, but it certainly is a long way around.
Yeah, it's a long way around. That's why the Gutenberg galaxy or the literate phase has been so long as a dominant medium. It's been a long way around. Now we're bypassed that with the speed of our present ESP society. What you were saying is what I meant, that they're pointing out. But they're book people, and book guys are trying to retrieve the power of the book to represent separateness.
You just wait, Bob. It won't be long till the marvelous, powerful creators will start grinding crystal. They'll start grinding crystal, and they'll stir it up and mix it up into colors, and they'll start painting with it. You just wait. You just wait.
Are you giving a hint to some of our painters in our audience?
You just hang tight. It's a coming, and they'll stand in awe. They'll stand in awe because it's the reference, because of this power. It's been thoroughly established in the Ark of the Covenant. It's been thoroughly established in the veil that separated. It's been thoroughly established that the veil was rent in two. It's been thoroughly established that that flow of power is coming back to the marvelous human creators. Back to Midia. Back to Midia. Right back, full circle. Right back, full circle. It's a marvelous, interesting, fabulous position when it starts showing up. And then you asked, Bob, many hours ago, where can I see this worked out? Where can I have an experience where I can see? And it's the soul, when can I experience it? And we say, hang on, Bob, it'll be here soon enough.
Hey, Karen, we got a good subtitle, Back to Midia. Okay.
This is literally, you know, the sign and the seal of God's presence, as I say.
Right.
And the manifestation of his power. So if you can direct and control divine power in some way, then you're the master of the universe. And I think that ultimately, the Templars were seeking power, magical divine power, through the Ark of the Covenant. I don't think they got it. I don't think it was ever brought back to Europe. I still think it's in Ethiopia.
Ah, he thinks Graham says the Ark is in Ethiopia. We're going to be.
Hell are you on the radio talking about it? Why aren't you in Ethiopia getting cancer and dragging it home with you?
You referring to him or me?
Him. If he thought he was in Ethiopia, why would he be having a chit chat about it, a fireside chat about it? Why ain't he there getting it?
Yeah, that's the ironic point.
They'll pay him a lot more money for the Ark of the Covenant than they will royalties on a show talking about where he knows it is.
So that the irony is that he's acting out the separateness that the Ark represents. He's separating himself from the power of the Ark.
I know where it is, and I've written a book about it, and I know all there is to know about it, and that's good, and here's the address, and buy my book, and you can have it.
Well, that's another point. He realizes that the book is way more powerful than the Ark of the Covenant, because there's more money in books than in the Ark of the Covenant at this point. So he actually knows how. He's not that interested. No, we know. No, I understand the Ark. Quadrillionaires, they got the Ark of the Covenant, but they paid dearly. But the
the thing is that he's using a popular charismatic object, the book, to get his power, and the content of the book he's not really interested in. He's not really interested in the Ark Covenant. It's just a good thing to sell books with.
Yeah, but I promise you, Bob, you put the Ark of the Covenant on eBay, and you'll see what royalties are like.
Yeah, it'll bring the quadrillionaires out of the woodwork.
Yeah, well, and give it with a money back guarantee. You can prove that it is. Well, when they buy it and they own it, you say, okay, now prove it. And they say, okay, stare real close. I'm going to open up the lid. You're not Levi, are you? Nope, I'm not Levi. I'm not Jewish. Okay, money back guarantee, double or nothing. Here, look right here and you can see. This is the Ark of the Covenant. You open the door and zap. Yeah. See, I proved it. It was. That's exactly right. Oh, you're dead? Okay, well, I'm paid, but I'm going to take it back home with me. Just because I don't want nobody to get hurt.
Okay.
I think that the Ethiopian claim is stronger than any other. There are some loose traditions that the Ark is buried under the Temple Mount, that it's buried in a mountain in Jordan. But mm-hmm. none of these are associated with a modern, ongoing, continuous tradition of veneration of the Ark of the Covenant. There's only one country in the world where the Ark is still venerated as a living object, and that is Ethiopia. And they've become masters of concealment. There are tunnels and systems underneath Aksum where the Ark can be carried away from any threat.
No,
the whole city is an armed camp, thousands of men with guns, and not to be taken lightly, because these are the men, the Tigrayans, who overthrew the dictatorship of Mengistu Haile Mariam. They're a powerful force, and the Ark is everything to them, and they protect it with their lives. But there are stories of escape routes, of tunnels, of places that the Ark can be taken out. And one very intriguing story from 1896, when the Italians invade Ethiopia, and the Italians were met by an Ethiopian force carrying the Ark of the Covenant, and the Italians were utterly defeated. It was the greatest ever defeat of a European by an African army in the whole history of the world.
No kidding.
And the Ethiopians also attribute that to the power of the Ark. So I think it's a very serious claim that they have.
So it has like a remote influencing ability, like it made them unable to fight somehow?
No, it strikes people dead.
Oh, really?
And the people
that run it can direct their minds
Yes, there's a sacred lineage involved in running it. So.
Okay, and that's a lot of gobbledygook, ridiculous statements in light of what you've been saying, but it sounds like the Ethiopians. Listen. The Ethiopians are carrying on the Knights Templars tradition. They're creating the myth that they got the Ark of the Covenant to do their thuggery around.
Okay. Well, then, here's JW's opinion of it. If that's the case, and that's true, and that's right, then the next time they ask for a handout for something to eat because they're starving to death, say, get you some of the damn manna from heaven that comes from the power from the Ark of the Covenant. So from now on, if any one of you starve to death, it's your own damn fault.
Okay, so, but you got my point that the
poorest country in the world and sitting there starving to death, and you got the Ark of the Covenant. You own the cattle of 1,000 hills. You ought not be wanting for milk.
So, the idea that the Knights Templars exploit the myth of the Solomon's Temple, the Ethiopians are trying to exploit the myth of the Ark of the Covenant, and it ain't working for them.
Well, they may have it, the Carpathian version of it, and it may be powerful, but so far all they've established is that they're the poorest country in the world, they're starving to death, and everybody that looks after it's got cancers and cataracts.
So that's an example of abstract concepts getting a literate man all tangled up in delusion and missing the obvious. So Graham Hancock is...
And illusions of grandeur.
Yeah, around the principle that undermines any grandeur that you actually could possess.
That's right. So then it would be delusions of grandeur.
Yeah.
Very good, Bob. Very good. Okay, is there
right,
more?
Right, so, yeah, the more is, let's we can drop Mr. Hancock and move on to tell us the rest of the story about where the Ark went after it got on the boats in Zimbabwe.
Okay. Now, it gets on a barge, and it's floating east, 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 east. Okay? And then it lands in a very special little place, and it's there for a very long time in Auckland.
New Zealand.
Yes.
And that would be before there was something called Auckland.
That is correct. That is correct. And
but that area.
And it could have stayed there except for it got off of the parallels. It got crossed up because, see, the Masons picked up on this with the 32nd degree and the 33rd degree and these linear lines and the 31st parallel. So then it had to go to China from Auckland before. Like
which dynasty was that? Which dynasty was that? When it got to China.
It was after the Mongol dynasty.
After Marco Polo went to China.
That's correct.
And that was, isn't that the 1600s? That's the Ming dynasty, isn't it?
That was the cross. That's what the wall, the beginning of all that wall business was about. But yes, it would have been the tail end of the Ming dynasty.
Okay. All right. And stayed there a long time?
He lasted a little longer than Ming. You got that right.
Right. So the, does it stay in China?
Yes.
That's where it is today? No. We, our colleagues have it now.
It moves
the Chinese
about.
Sold it? What?
They didn't sell it. It moves about.
As you get into the... As you get into the world... As you get into the world of jet travel, it can move around easier.
Yeah, it sure can. It gives a new meaning to the stratosphere, doesn't it?
Yeah. So you were going to say something. I interrupted
that. The answer is, it's still on the 31st parallel. And it's where it's been the longest, has been in China, and it does move about.
And does it have Levites protecting
it? Yes, it does.
And so there are Jewish people associated with it?
They are from the true part sons of Levi. They are.
Right, so you're implying that it's moved around on the 33rd, 33rd. Yeah, it if you want to know how it's moved, once it left Zimbabwe, they moved it along the 33rd, 32nd parallel?
No. They can move it anywhere, but it won't stay long. It'll come back to the 31st, 32nd, 33rd parallel.
Excellent. And I would like to end on that point. There's a big mystery revealed there.
Very good. Very good.
So thank you, Ed.
This has been great fun. Great fun. We appreciate Ed. Thank you again for making it available. It's very, very delicious. We love to play all day, every day. We hope all your listening audience enjoys it immensely. This is just scratching the surface. This is just the beginning. This is just laying some of the foundational garments that will come into your place of your power. The point of having this interaction is for human creators to come into their place of power, not our power, your power. And at the end of the day, if you're listening to somebody that doesn't bring you back into your power, then it's delusional and confused. It doesn't serve you at all. If it's going to make for contrast to bring you to the place that you can have conscious thoughts, conscious, and we don't even like that word, but those that don't have their power have to serve their conscious. But if that's the case, it's all right. Use it till you can use it, till you can do better. It'll do till you can do better. Then you come into the place where you can embrace your very own power. That's what we're here for. That's what we came forth for. That's why we've always been here. We've just been sitting on the levee waiting on the Robert E. Lee. And therefore we are eternally, completely, forever, deliciously incomplete.
Thank you,
Well, thank you, Bob and Ion and Hollywood, if you're listening. I think we have the beginnings of an Indiana Jones sequel.
That's right. And